weather is extreme. It's the planet on steroids.
The current count for the number of moons that Jupiter has is 95. It seems a more familiar planet because we've been able to see it so up close.
Hello and welcome to the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
Yeah, this month we're exploring the largest planet in our solar system, Jupiter. What do we know about this big old planet and what are the missions that we'll find out even more?
I mean, it absolutely is the monster of our solar system. It holds a special place in my heart that I know Becky will disagree with.
Yeah. But justice for Saturn.
sorry. But today it's all about Jupiter. Okay, so deal with it. And obviously, Dr. Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society, is here too. So, Robert, tell us about Jupiter. What's it like as a planet?
You're definitely right that the key word is big, at least by the standards of our solar system. And for us, that means it's bright as well. It's reflecting a lot of sunlight. It's brighter than any star apart from the sun and every planet except Venus and just occasionally Mars when it's at its closest to the Earth. Now, this planet is 140,000 kilometers across, so you could fit 1,300 Earths inside it, which always blows my mind a little bit. And it spins so fast in just under 10 hours that it actually bulges out at the equator. And you can see that even with a pair of binoculars. You look at it and you think, oh, it's not round. It's actually slightly bulging out a bit. And with a telescope, it's really obvious. It's mostly hydrogen and helium, like our sun, but that's because it's got a strong gravitational field, so it can hold on to those lighter gases a lot more easily than planets like the Earth can. And if you were able to stand on its surface, it doesn't have a solid surface, lots of caveats here, but if you were sort of at the bit, you know, the bit you can see, the top of the atmosphere, the gravitational field there would mean you'd weigh 2.5 times what you do on Earth. Now, that's not something I in particular would relish. It takes about 12 years to go around the sun, and we've just had a really good view of it over the winter, and it'll be at its best again in November this year when it'll be really, really high up and bright again from the UK. So something to look forward to towards the end of this year.
And I mean, I think that puts it into perspective that it spins in just 10 hours, but even just like the size of it. I mean, that would be fast for Earth.
Yeah.
But then you think about just how big it is and you're like, no, hang on, that's too much.
Yeah. Like if you think about it, like on a winter night, like on Earth, like a longer night, you could set up a time lapse where you could see the entirety of Jupiter rotate.
That, oh my God.
That's incredible. Like it's insane, right?
I now really want to do that. Why have we just gone through the window and like properly seeing it at its best point? Like, missed the boat on that one.
It's your challenge for your telescope, Izzy. You've got the telescope.
Yes,
you can do this.
I just need all the thermal layers.
Put a date in your diary for November.
Sorry, busy. Just got to watch Jupiter all night.
Cheers, Robert. Then we'll catch up with you later in the show to help me take on some listener questions.
So our interest in Jupiter goes way back. In 1609, Galileo used his newly improved telescope design to observe moons orbiting Jupiter. And fast forward to 1989, and NASA's Galileo mission became the first spacecraft to orbit an outer planet. So what do we know about Jupiter, and how is NASA's current mission to the giant planet changing that? I spoke with Scott Bolton from Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas, who's the principal investigator of the Juno mission.
So Jupiter is the monster in our solar system. It is extreme. It's the planet on steroids. Okay, so not only is it the largest, but it has the most hazardous radiation belts, the largest magnetic field. It's spinning the fastest. It's moving around in 10 hours, this giant planet, right? So all the material in its magnetosphere is sweeping around in just 10 hours, even stuff that's far away. And its magnetic field goes all the way back out to Saturn. So it's extreme in every way. I mean, it probably not only was the first planet, but it probably dictated how the whole solar system was formed, even the collection and distribution of volatiles and organics that led to life and led to Earth. And its storms, you know, the Great Red Spot, goes all the way back as far as we've had telescopes to detect it. So it's thought to be maybe 300 years or more. So it's got this, the biggest storms as well. The storms are being driven by its fast rotation. It also receives sunlight like that drives our storms, but it's probably driven mostly internally. Even its magnetosphere and aurora are probably driven by this giant engine of the magnetosphere that's whipping around so fast.
Yeah, I mean, It's incredible. I love it as a planet. And I think, you know, the red spot that we look at, it's so iconic. For anyone that hasn't seen that, you know, what is going on there? Do we know why it's red? Do we know what's happening at that point?
We don't exactly know why it's red. We believe it's chemicals. You know, it's the chemical composition. And when you look at Jupiter, you see these stripes, right? These zones and belts. They're very beautiful. And they're different colors, right? Orangey and yellow. And then you have this whitish ones. Some are zones, some are belts. They're actually moving in different directions, kind of like our weather, but the weather pattern is much more complex in that it has different zones and they go in one direction and the other ones go in another. They're going at different speeds. The colors are probably representative of composition of the clouds and the material, but also the depth. It could be a hang glider's dream if they could survive. I mean, you've got all these vortices. They look like hurricanes or tornadoes, and they're all over the place. The Great Red Spot is just a giant one. It's like a giant, you know, vortex that's just sitting there. We do see it changing. In recent times, we've seen that its size has changed since the days of Pioneer and Voyager. So it is alive. I mean, the whole planet is alive and it's evolving and changing with time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you mentioned a few missions there. So how do we know all of this about Jupiter? We're going to get to Juno later, but pre-Juno, how have we been able to understand Jupiter and study it as a planet?
So the initial idea was just telescopes. Galileo could detect the movement of the moons, but really couldn't see the cyclones spinning around like a vortex. However, as we got more advanced and we started sending spacecraft out, we started inventing instruments that could detect charged particles, magnetic fields, invisible force fields. And so we went to visit this planet. And when you got close, the first thing we realized was it had a giant magnetosphere. So we started to realize that also from ground-based telescopes, radio telescopes, looked at radio emission coming out of Jupiter and realized it must have a magnetic field. But then, of course, Galileo learned a lot when we dropped the probe into the atmosphere.
Yeah. And now we're moving on to Juno. I mean, you're the PI of this mission. Tell us about Juno. What is its aims and what is it doing around Jupiter?
So Juno is a very different kind of spacecraft and mission than anything we had ever tried before. So Voyager and Pioneer and Galileo orbited around its equator, basically, but we didn't have enough measurement to know what its interior was like. So Juno was designed to look at it in a new way. We had more modern instruments, of course, but we also went really close. So we're an armored tank that we knew we were going into this monster, and we were armed so that we could go into that planet really close. We also went into a polar orbit so that we could see from the top to the bottom for the first time, very, very close. Our orbit was designed to get in close and then get out before we got killed by the radiation. So we are moving really fast. We come very close to Jupiter. We go over its poles and we go to within 5,000 kilometers of its cloud tops, which is very, very close. And we're moving really fast. And so we go from pole to pole in about 2 hours. And each time we dove in, we tried to understand what was it like inside this planet. The atmosphere was like below the cloud tops and much deeper than the Galileo probe went. We also got very precise measurements of the radio science or the gravity field. So we could tell what was the core like. You know, what was it like, the structure inside of Jupiter?
And the pictures from the Juno mission are absolutely stunning. So what have been some of the big discoveries that Juno has showed us? And were there any that were quite surprising for you?
Almost everywhere we were surprised, and almost every field. And it's a very humbling experience for all the scientists. It's exciting. You like to be surprised. But I don't think anybody expected that we would be wrong by almost everything.
Like what?
So the first thing was we took a picture of the pole in the infrared and in the visible and saw giant cyclones all over the pole. So instead of the zones and belts, the stripes like we were used to, they were replaced by giant polar cyclones on both poles. So you had five on one pole, like a pentagon. And on the other pole, you had eight distributed like an octagon. Nobody expected that. These, we've been watching them ever since, and they seem pretty stable. Sometimes it looks like one's opening up and there's going to be a new one formed, or they'll change. But by the time we go around again, that new one was kicked out and there's still the same number. So it's a very exclusive club. They don't just let any polygon polar cyclone in there. So that was the first surprise. And we're still trying to figure out how all the atmosphere works. We were searching for, was there a core of heavy elements at the center, a compact core, or was there none at all? And we found out that it was neither. We weren't even asking the right question. What's inside of Jupiter is, it, there is a core, but it's sort of dilute and fuzzy and quite large. And so there's a gradient in it as you go in. Nobody really expected that. There may be a small compact core in the center of that, but the question of how Jupiter formed was thrown another curveball.
And one thing that we've talked about in this podcast before is Jupiter and its magnetic field. So what have you found out anything about that thanks to Juno?
Yeah, we mapped out the magnetic field, and the magnetic field has not only got a lot of structure, we discovered a big spot in the middle of it that we called the Great Blue Spot that kind of looks like the Great Red Spot, but in magnetic field eyes. And it's not far from the Great Red Spot. It's a little bit in the south. And at some point, it once in a while goes over the Great Red Spot, because the Great Red Spot is moving around at one speed, but of course, the magnetic field is moving around much faster. And once in a while, they go over each other. I don't know if how they might affect each other, but we have this giant Great Blue Spot, which we've actually been able to measure changes in. So we've seen what we call secular variation. So far, we've only measured a change in the magnetic field over time at Earth. And here we now see that Jupiter has the same thing. And we're also looking at where is the magnetic field formed? And it seems in a pretty shallow region. And so we're seeing a coupling for the first time between an atmosphere, the magnetosphere, and maybe the gravity field. And that's something that Juno has really uncovered, that these three, we kind of always knew that they must have been interacting, but often they were studied separately. We're now having to join forces, you know, interdisciplinary perspectives are all is what really drives Juno science at this
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. So finally, what's next?
So we finished what was called our primary mission in the summer of 2021. And that was all dictated by a number of orbits. We were trying to go really close to Jupiter 32 times to spread out and map the planet at every longitude. And then we said, okay, what can we do now that we've mapped the planet out? And our orbit was getting twisted by Jupiter's giant gravity field. And so as it got twisted, we realized we were going to go cross the planes of the satellites where at their orbital distance. We designed it so we could go close. So we went by Ganymede in the summer of 2021. In September of 2022, we went by Europa, really close, made maps and new images and things like that. And then in December of this year and February of next year, we'll go by Io. And all the whole time we're being twisted around. So we're also getting closer and closer to the northern hemisphere. So we're getting close-ups of these incredible polar cyclones, right? We also, as you said, the images are amazing. And that's part of the is that we're watching the beauty of Jupiter reveal itself in the sense that the clouds are all twisted. It almost looks like a Van Gogh painting. And the lightning, there's these little polar, or I should say, top ice clouds that are probably ammonia ice. We call them pop-up clouds. That's where we think a lot of storms and lightning are occurring. We're getting closer and closer to that, making maps of this. You're seeing inside. So you're looking for these hot spots that look like where the Galileo probe went in. So we're studying the northern hemisphere in both the gravity field, the magnetic field, as well as the atmosphere. But we're also studying the satellites. And equally exciting, we're getting closer and closer to the rings of Jupiter. They're not like Saturn's, but they're very close to Jupiter, but they're not well understood. There haven't been a lot of observations or telescopes or spacecraft that could go in that close. And so we're actually getting really close, and we're going to learn a lot about the rings and probably the tiny moons that might be moving around inside of those, sort of like a mini Saturn ring system.
Thank you to Scott Bolton. See, at least there's been some mention of Saturn there for you, Becky. It's fine. That's it covered.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So we talk about Jupiter and its main four moons, but how many moons does Jupiter actually have, and do we know where they've come from?
Yeah, so at the current count for the number of moons that Jupiter has is 95. And that has gone up by three since February 2023, when three more were announced, like the discoveries were announced. Okay, okay. So we're discovering all the time, because these three that have been recently discovered are, you know, they're like a kilometer across. So they're not very big. They're not that easy to spot, you know, compared to the Galileo moons, which are all over like 3,000 kilometers.
Yeah, fair enough.
Ganymede is actually larger than Mercury, which I think helps to put it into perspective. You know, there are some people that argue that these moons should almost be classed as planets because they are, you know, such major players like in the solar system. So
yeah,
all the other moons though of Jupiter are less than sort of 250 kilometers across. Most of them are in that sort of 1 to 5 kilometer range. So we think that those sort of smaller moons, you know, orbiting further out from Jupiter are very likely to be captured asteroids that Jupiter's just gone, yoink, I'll have you, basically.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
There's probably a lot more of those where that came from that we just haven't been able to spot yet, maybe smaller than a kilometer as well. But the larger moons, especially those Galilean moons around Jupiter itself, we think they actually formed around Jupiter. So like in situ, if you will, in the very same way that the planets formed around the sun, sort of with this disk of swirling material, where you have this sort of like coalescence of all of these much smaller bits of rock that then, you know, come together and eventually form the planets, or around Jupiter, form Jupiter's moons.
And I think it's brilliant. You know, I will never forget the first time I looked through a telescope and you see Jupiter and you see these four main moons. And you're like, oh my gosh, those are other moons. That's one, that's another planet. But also, those are its moons. And it's just that, almost that entry point into looking at other planets. You're like, oh my goodness, this is just brilliant.
Well, I love it because they're all obviously on the same line, the Galilean moons as well. So it looks like a mini solar system as you look at it, you know? Like every artist impression that you've seen of the solar system, it's like finally seeing that in real life, you know?
Well, absolutely. And that leads me on to my next question, because we talk about Jupiter's system and, you know, when we're looking at other systems outside our own. So what can studying Jupiter's system tell us about other systems out there in space?
That's all the systems, is it?
All of them. Every single one of them.
Yeah. It can tell us a lot, actually, because especially with this idea of how moons and planets migrate from where they form to where they're actually orbiting, you know, a planet or a star right now. If we think about Jupiter's system, we actually ended up in a situation where three of those Galilean moons are in what's called resonance. So for every one orbit that Ganymede makes, Europa makes two orbits, and Io, very close into Jupiter, makes four orbits. And the reason they've ended up like that is because they formed, migrated inwards, and essentially got trapped there in that resonance, sort of in the sort of like gravity, sort of keeping them like that, and sort of the tidal forces. You've then got Callisto, which is the furthest out of Jupiter's moons, which is still migrating inwards. And eventually, we think it will be captured in that resonance, so that for every one orbit Callisto makes, Ganymede makes two, Europa makes four, and Io makes eight. So instead of 1, 2, 4, you've got 1, 2, 4, 8, sort of carrying on the chain. So like almost like we're watching that happen, I say. I mean, it's, you know, it's going to be a very, 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 very long time in the future that actually does happen.
Next week.
If only. That would be the dream, wouldn't it? But sort of this migration is very important if we think about then what happens to planetary systems if this happens as well. When we simulate our solar system forming, we know that Jupiter must have tried to migrate inwards at some point, and actually Saturn held it back and stopped it, which means that maybe that's the reason Earth is even here in the first place, because if Jupiter made it this far in, we probably would have been shot out of the solar system along with a lot of other bodies in the solar system. And this is how we think actually that, do you remember from our exoplanets episode, we talked about hot Jupiters. So Jupiter-sized planets orbiting very close into their stars, like with orbits of like, you know, days, weeks even. And they're incredibly hot because of that. We think that's how they've got there. So studying Jupiter's moon system actually ends up sort of helping us learn how hot Jupiters around exoplanets form, and also why that didn't happen in our own solar system as well. So Jupiter has lots of moons, and one upcoming ESA mission is off to explore the icy ones. It's called JUICE, aka the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, and it's the first European mission to go to the Jupiter system. It'll be looking at the Galilean moons, Europa, Callisto, and has a particular focus on the largest of them all, which is Ganymede.
But why are we going there, and what is JUICE hoping to find? Professor Emma Bunce from the University of Leicester has the answers. She's been involved with building two instruments on JUICE, and we spoke at a rather crucial time.
So we've got to the really exciting part. The launch window starts on the 13th of April. So hopefully JUICE will go as quickly as possible within that launch window. So it's going to be launched April 2023, and then we'll spend 8.25 years in what we call the cruise phase between leaving Earth and arriving at Jupiter. So the arrival of it at Jupiter is not until 2031.
Okay.
That will be Jupiter orbit insertion. Okay, so first of all, the spacecraft will go into orbit around Jupiter. And then we'll do a number of things like the Europa flybys. We'll have an inclined phase where we'll have Callisto flybys. And then the spacecraft will transfer to Ganymede. So the orbit's getting smaller such that it gets closer to Ganymede. That phase takes about a year and will involve multiple Ganymede flybys. And then finally, we'll be ready to go into orbit at Ganymede in December 2034. So
Wow. We're
launching in April 2023. And we will get to the Ganymede orbit, which is the real focus of the mission, in December 2034. And then the mission will last until 2035.
Wow. Okay. So quite the journey.
Indeed.
We'll get onto the icy moons in a moment. But it's starting off around Jupiter. So what can it tell us about Jupiter as a planet?
So JUICE is going to spend that first part of the mission, so between 2031 and 2034, really exploring the Jupiter system as a whole. And in some ways, that is an extension of the work that the Galileo mission did back in the 1990s, but with a much more capable spacecraft and with new technology, new instruments. We're going to be able to look at Jupiter's atmosphere with some of the more up-to-date instruments for imaging and for spectroscopy to find out what the cloud motions and composition of the atmosphere, let's say. And we'll also be able to look at Jupiter's giant magnetosphere. So this is the space environment containing Jupiter's magnetic field and charged particles extending out far into space around Jupiter. So this very large magnetosphere then rotates around with the planet and the planet's magnetic field and sweeps past all of these moons that we're interested in. And we'll be able to look at how that rotating magnetosphere is interacting with each of those moons. So that's a really exciting part of the mission as well. There's a lot to learn about how the system acts as a whole.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, what's the importance of understanding all of these mechanisms of Jupiter's system and its icy moons? Why do we want to explore this in the first place?
Well, I think we have to come back to that question of habitability. I think there are lots of reasons why we as scientists are interested in exploring the system. But this question of habitability and the idea that at Europa and at Ganymede is potentially more water, liquid water in the subsurface underneath icy crusts than is across the entire Earth is a fairly mind-blowing discovery that was you know, the tantalising evidence coming from Galileo. And we need to confirm and explore the details and the characteristics of those oceans. And that's a really important science question, because whenever we're thinking about whether there could be life somewhere else in the universe, one of the properties that we're thinking about is where is the water? And, you know, looking for water on Mars, etc. And yet you go to the outer solar system and there apparently is just enormous volumes of water in these moons. And so that's what makes them very exciting. This is the next step. I think is a good way of looking at it. So we are confident that there's a subsurface ocean at Europa, and we want to find out more about whether there is a global ocean at Ganymede and whether there is a potential ocean signature at Callisto. So JUICE is going to be able to do that through 35 flybys of those moons, but also this final phase where the spacecraft actually will go into orbit. And that's the first time a spacecraft will be going into orbit around an icy moon in the outer solar system. So it's very exciting that that's a European mission doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, just the idea of these subsurface oceans as well. Like, you just want to find out more about those, don't you? So what instruments will be on board and what will it be trying to detect? I mean, are we going to be getting images? You know, we've seen some of the Juno images. They're amazing. Is that something we'll get from JUICE?
Oh, gosh, the imaging is incredible. So I was looking at this detail. So going back to Galileo again, the visible imager, the resolution was around a few kilometres. And the best resolution for the imager on JUICE is going to be around 2.5 metres per pixel.
Oh, wow.
So you can expect to see the most incredible map of Ganymede, which will be amazing. And then obviously we have some instruments like spectroscopy instruments, UV and infrared, which allow us to consider things like composition. So we want to know whether some of that essential chemistry that we're looking for that contributes to this question of habitability is present on the surface. You know, what's on the surface of Ganymede? And indeed in the tenuous atmosphere that exists around the moon. But JUICE also has a laser altimeter, which will actually allow measurements of that tidal deformation. So we actually think that tidal forces move the surfaces of the moons, Europa, Io, Europa and Ganymede. And we need to quantify what that motion can be. And so the laser altimeter, for example, will be able to help with that. JUICE also has an ice penetrating radar that is able to look down to around a 10 kilometer depth in the ice to see, you know, what the signals are coming back underneath, what the structure of that ice actually looks like. And the very exciting instrument, which is the UK instrument on board, the magnetometer, is on a very long boom, an 11 metre boom, which keeps the instrument very far from the spacecraft and allows very precise magnetic field measurements. And
yeah, I was going to say just a boom is essentially, for simple terms, a big long stick.
A big long stick, exactly.
Whatever you want to call it, but yeah.
And it's really important because it allows a precision of measurement that will really allow us to tell the difference between an induced magnetic field signature relating to an ocean, and Ganymede also has its own internal magnetic field, which is the only moon in the solar system that we know that has that. Mm. And we need to understand the interplay between those two things. And then there's sort of gravitational field measurements that can be done as well that contributes to that question. So they're all working together. And that's really important. And that's why that payload has been selected for JUICE.
And so if it has its own magnetic field, does that tell us anything about its core, or are we literally just, that's the whole point of JUICE, is to try and get to the bottom of that question?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the simple answer is yes. We're going to be able to use the gravitational field measurements to understand the distribution of mass within the interior of Ganymede. The magnetic field measurements will enable us to work out the properties of the internally driven field. And by looking at the complex terms in the field, you can essentially work out from where they are generated. And that's a really important question. And then obviously the other instruments all working together will just give us unprecedented detail at Ganymede.
Thank you to Professor Emma Bunce. And fingers crossed that JUICE will begin that journey in just a few weeks. Oh my goodness, so
yeah.
Exciting.
Oh, I'm going to be watching the launch with just all of my fingers crossed and then waiting very impatiently for the next like 8 years.
Yeah, waiting 2030, come on TikTok, hurry up. Yeah.
This is the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
This month, it's all about the largest planet in our solar system, and that is Jupiter.
Before we get on to everybody's questions, though, Izzy has some very exciting news to share. Izzy, Drumroll, please.
Yes. I'm so excited to say that I have a kid's book coming out on the 30th of March, 2023. So that is very, very soon.
That's so exciting. I'm like, what age range is the kid's book for, you know, any parents or aunts or uncles listening or grandparents who want to get it for their kids?
Yeah. So it's called Everyday STEM Science Space, and it's for 9 to 11 year olds. But let me say, like, if it's been a while since you've done some space science, then perhaps this is a good place to begin re-engaging with astronomy. But no, it's all about how space science comes back down to Earth. So, I've done a bit of a tour of the International Space Station in there. And we've got a guide to an astronaut suit and our solar system and what goes beyond. And ultimately, it was so much fun. The illustrator is a guy called James Lancet. And the colours of this book are amazing. And, you know, it was great seeing it on screen when we were making it, but to see it as an actual book, I got it in hard copy a few weeks ago and I was like, oh my God, it's an actual book. It looks amazing, if I do say so myself. So yeah.
I'm very excited. I mean, I know I would have devoured this as a kid, like not even as 9-year-old. I think if you'd bought me this as like a 6-year-old, I would have been like,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly. And I think there are some things in there that maybe slightly younger readers will sort of, you know, pick up and understand. But it's actually part of a series. So I've just written the space one. So the overall book, the overall series is Everyday STEM Science. And there's 8 of them in there. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of other ones. If space isn't your jam, I don't really know why you're listening to this podcast then.
or space isn't your kid's jam, maybe.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I'm very sorry for you if you're a parent and that is the case. But
yeah, so yes, out on the 30th of March. But I'll put a link to it in the episode description so everyone can find it. Brilliant. But enough about that. Let's get on to the questions. So Robert Martin Gregg wants to know, would a human crew be able to survive travelling through the Jovian system? And perhaps this is a good place to say that when we refer to Jupiter and some of its moons, that is the Jovian system.
The answer is it's really hard, Martin. And the reason for that is it's got an incredibly high radiation level. They're high enough that they fry the electronics on a spacecraft if it's not really protected. So Juno had to be, you know, I think if it gets damaged on each pass around Jupiter, it has to be really hardened and reset all the time. And so it's really difficult to do. So imagine then taking people there into an environment where near the planet itself, you've got 1,000 times the lethal dose of radiation out there, trying to protect astronauts from that is going to be incredibly difficult. So you'd have to do things like put lots of lead shielding around the craft or water or basically dense materials and a lot of it. And that's really difficult with the spacecraft because then you need more and more fuel to launch it and to move it around and so on. So another thing you can try and do is magnetic shielding. But again, I think when you're in that sort of environment, it's a really difficult thing to do. So it's not a very safe place to go, if you ask me. When you get even some of the moons, the ones that we want to visit and Juice will be looking at, even they have quite high doses until you get out as far as Callisto, I think. So it's not going to be an easy tourist destination anytime too. And to give you a bit of context, we worry about what happens to astronauts on the space station over time. They get, you know, a reasonable amount of radiation over a year if they're up there, but 6 months a year if they're up there that long. We worry a lot more about what it might do to people traveling to and from Mars. They might get their lifetime dose of radiation or even more that they're supposed to have over that period. So going to Jupiter is on another level altogether. So my honest advice is probably it's not a good place to go and look at. And if you're going to go there, look at it from a safe distance.
Okay. And also, surely the journey would just be really, really, really
there is the whole issue of getting there. Yeah, that's not trivial either, spending years and years in space. You know, I always say to people on long space missions, think of the maybe it's better to travel with people who aren't your friends because you won't, you know, you've got less risk of falling out. Whereas if you go with your friends, you know, and you really don't want to put that friendship to that kind of test, I suggest. Interesting question. You know, look around your friendship group and think, who would I like to spend 8 years cooped up in a small space with?
I'm now really wondering how the COVID-19 lockdowns will affected the percentage of people who are willing to actually go on a long space journey. Like, do you think before people were like, yeah, I'd be up for an 8-year journey to Jupiter, and now they're like, no, I did not survive 3 months in isolation. Like, I can not do 8 years.
Exactly, no. Well, there's probably another entire podcast on that one. So Becky, yeah. Holly McFall has a question about Jupiter's colours. She asks, why is Jupiter so many different colours? Is it different gases?
Yeah, it's exactly that, Holly. So you have different elements and molecules which absorb and reflect different wavelengths of sunlight. So the same way that, you know, if you're looking at a blue wall, it's because that blue paint is, you know, only reflecting the blue sunlight back to you. So most of Jupiter is hydrogen and helium, as Robert said earlier, but as storms form on Jupiter, you get a lot of mixing through convection. So convection is this heat transfer, you know, where essentially what we say all the time, right? Heat rises, cold sinks. And so you get this sort of cycle of dredging up of materials from lower down in the atmosphere of Jupiter, like, for example, sulfur with its sort of distinctive yellowish color. You might have phosphorus coming up as well, ammonia, things like that. But then also like hydrocarbons. So these big long chains of carbon bonded with hydrogen, the things that give us methane for very small chains, but then, you know, longer chains go up to sort of like all like your petrol and everything like that. When that happens, you then get those materials condensing in the clouds, and then that's how you get this reflection of all these different colors in the sort of clouds that you see on Jupiter. And also these clouds, they split into these different bands because of the winds on Jupiter. So you've seen some of the winds are, if you can find online, there's a really great GIF, you know, a time lapse of Jupiter is sort of like flattened out into a map. So you can see things moving sort of like left and right in these different bands, which I never get tired of watching, in these opposite directions. And so because it's in these opposite directions, you get these very clear boundaries between sort of different layers in the clouds with different molecules in them that give it that sort of distinctive stripes. And then we get very interesting features on the boundaries as well, where you've got obviously two things moving in opposite directions.
Yeah. And I just think even the images from Juno that we've seen recently, just the amount of detail that you can see in those and all the swirls and the different colors of Jupiter, it seems a more familiar planet because of it, because we've been able to see it so up close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And dolphins and find patterns as if they're just like, you know, lying on the back garden looking for patterns in clouds on Earth. It's a similar thing when you get these images of Jupiter, right? Like, oh, what can you see in the clouds? It's very oddly familiar.
Yeah. And on a similar vein, Robert, See Me So Crochet on Instagram asks, how long is the red spot expected to last? Forever? 100 years? 1,000 years?
And the honest answer is we really, really don't know. We think it was seen. A spot was certainly seen in the mid 17th century, so not that long after the invention of the telescope, a few decades later, when they got good enough to see those sort of details. And if it's the same one, then it's lasted more than 350 years so far, although there don't seem to have been many observations for about a century, from 1713 to 1831, you know, people weren't recording it. There is, I've discovered a painting from 1711 by the Italian artist Donato Creti, which is not bad, which shows bands on Jupiter and what looks very like the modern spot, but we're just not sure if it is. But it has been shrinking a lot recently. So if you go back 100 years, it was about maybe 50,000 kilometres across. And now, so, you know, several times the size of the Earth. Now it's only about 16,000 kilometers across, so only a bit bigger than the Earth. It's still enormous. I mean, there's still a storm that's bigger than the whole Earth, but it's half what it was 100 years ago, a third what it was before that. So it might be disappearing. It might be dissipating. It might be that there's some cycle where it shrinks down and grows again, and we just don't know. We've just got to keep watching to find out. And personally, I would miss it because I've never really seen it properly, and I'd quite like to. And I've looked at Jupiter through some quite big telescopes and never convincingly see it. It might be my eyes, my powers of observation, I don't know, but I still really like to see it. So I sort of hope it bounces back and it becomes obvious.
Just say it was always wrong at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't
you just,
me.
You always just missed it. every single time. Maybe that's what happened from 1713 to 1831 as well. Every single time.
One thing I was going to add was that there is an example like this on Neptune, where something was discovered by the Voyager probes called the Great Dark Spot. And people at the back in 1989, people assumed, or I think might have imagined, that was a permanent feature. But when the Hubble telescope looked at Neptune a few years later, it had gone. So there is sort of a precedent for these things. You know, we don't necessarily know how long these big weather systems last.
So finally, Becky, we've had a question from Max Mullins, and he asks, what is Jupiter's gravitational pull on the planets?
So it's actually bigger than you'd think. Like, you know, the sun is like 99% of the mass of the solar system. So you don't think that Jupiter, even as big as it would have such a massive impact, but it really does. So first of all, you've got to remember that the planets aren't sort of orbiting the very center of the sun. Like the sun and whatever planet you pick are orbiting the center of mass between them.
Yeah.
And Jupiter is so big that the center of mass between the sun and Jupiter is actually 46 kilometers above the sun's surface. It's outside of the sun, technically. So the sun is orbiting that tiny bit.
Ooh, that's a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm always surprised by it. I think it would be like 46 kilometers from the center of the sun, not from the surface of the sun, you know?
Yeah.
And so obviously it's because Jupiter is the biggest planet that happens. Like, the bigger the planet, the more that center of mass is pulled from the center of the sun. Like, Earth doesn't, you know, near as much change that sort of center of mass. It's still inside the sun. So that was very exciting. And it really puts into perspective how much of a big player it is in the solar system. Now, obviously, we've got to remember that the pull of gravity is sort of drops off with the square of the distance you are away from something. So the further away you are from Jupiter, the less of an impact it is going to have. But it's still enough to change the path of asteroids, for example, even tear an asteroid apart if the gravity that's actually keeping those just sort of like, you know, rubble pile together isn't strong enough. Jupiter can do that. It's also cleared areas of the asteroid belt and just been like, No asteroid's going to hang out here.
Absolutely not.
Because of its gravity. We also think that the reason that the asteroid belt exists in the first place, i.e. why that just sort of all that rubble didn't coalesce to form another planet, is because of Jupiter. Jupiter again just went, nope, not happening.
This is my patch.
The other thing it does is it pulls on the orbits of all the other planets as well. So one of the reasons that the orbits of the planets are elliptical, or as elliptical as they are, is because of Jupiter pulling on them. And there is actually a study I found from 2008, and I think you're going to love this, Izzy, from Battigin and Laughlin, who ran a simulation of the solar system, like evolution going forward with all of sort of the gravitational interactions taken into account. And they found that Jupiter's gravity eventually pulls on Mercury's orbit so much that it completely disrupts Mercury's orbit. And depending on like lots of other factors, there's then four options for what happens to Mercury. Either it just falls onto the sun and crisps, burns and dies. Or it gets completely ejected from the solar system and it becomes like an interstellar object.
Right.
Or it crashes into Venus or Earth.
Okay. Slight problem. Yeah.
That's a science fiction film right there then.
Yeah. We're going to add that to our list of like science fiction films that we should write.
Yeah, we should totally write this. And the thing is, obviously, this isn't going to happen for like over like 1.5 billion years. So obviously, our sci-fi has to have a believable reason why we've sped up that time scale. But
minor details.
Baby. Yeah. But I think it just really shows like the power that Jupiter does have in the solar system as sort of the next biggest thing from the sun.
Oh, Max, what a brilliant question. Thanks for sorting that one, baby. Yeah, great.
I had such a good dive. Yeah,
I'm well into that.
Yeah. Scientific literature being like, ooh, what have I found here?
Jupiter, great planet. Fascinating. Well, thank you everyone for sending in your questions. And if you have a question for us, then do email us at podcast@ras.ac.uk. You can tweet us at Royal Astrosoc or slide into the DMs on Instagram. It's at Supermassive Pod. So, Robert, what can we see in the night sky this month?
Well, sadly, Jupiter is really tough to see. It's very low down in the west, but there's a good few other things as usual. So if you look in the evening sky in the first part of April, it's a chance to see Mercury a long time before it's thrown out the solar system, I stress. If you look over in the west, it's never very, very bright, and it's only very briefly visible, usually only for a few days at a time, maybe 10 days or so. So the first bit of April, look about 30 minutes after sunset. Obviously, the sun has to have set. You know, no chance if the sun's above the horizon. It's dangerous to stare at it anyway. But if you want to glimpse the innermost world, it's a good time to do it. Let the sky darken and then look over, and then, you know, grab a pair of binoculars, get an app like Stellarium or whatever in your phone, and you should be able to find it. In terms of photogenic opportunities, there's a nice one, which is Venus near the Pleiades on the 9th to the 10th of April. That's always, you know, if you get a camera, stop it down, you can see some really lovely views there. The Pleiades is a cluster of stars, and Venus is obviously the brightest planet in the sky. If you're traveling, and you're very lucky, if you're going down to the northwest Cape of Australia, I think you're probably doing this purposefully. There's actually a total solar eclipse on the 20th of April. So I know a few people who are going down there, and good luck to them. I wish them clear skies. Not going to see anything from the UK, but, you know, in the rest of Australia, for example, they will see a partial eclipse. There's a meteor shower on the 23rd of April, the Lyrid meteor shower. Not massive rates, 15 to 20 an hour. So probably you're going to see maybe half, a third of that number number on top of what you normally see, but it's nice to look at, and the moon isn't going to be a problem. So if you've got a dark, clear sky, that's definitely worth looking out for. And generally, we're moving very much into the time of year, of spring stars. So you're going to have Ursa Major high in the sky, the Great Bear, including the seven stars, the Plough, really high overhead once you get into the evening sky in April. You can use that as a signpost for other things. If you follow the curve of the tail or the handle, if you prefer, you can find the bright star Arcturus in Boötes, or you can go up to the pole star using the pointers. Once you've found the pole star, the nice thing is it's always in the same place in the sky. So if you look out in your garden, no matter what the time of year, it'll always be there. And Leo the Lion is sitting underneath the Plough and the Ursa Major. And this region of the sky, the Milky Way, isn't as bright. But what that means is you're more able to see things like galaxies and so on. And most of them do look like fuzzies. But if you want to look at some, you get a decentish pair of binoculars, a small telescope. It's a good time to be doing that. And there are a couple of bright, compact, globular star clusters to see as well. So, you know, the spring sky, it's getting a bit warmer, which is always a plus. The nights are still reasonably long, even after the clocks go forward. So, you know, take advantage of that. Go and enjoy the view.
Oh, lots of things to see. Thanks for that, Robert. And I think that's it for this month. We'll be back next month. And I purposely haven't put this in the running order because, Becky, next month is going to be all about Saturn.
Yay! Did you do that just for me?
Maybe. Aww. It's about time. It's taking us, what, we started this podcast in 2020, so maybe, just maybe, it's about time we did an episode on Saturn.
I'm so excited. We're going to bring the A game for this one. Not that we don't always bring the A game, but you know what I mean? I'm going to be like extra excited for this one.
Oh my God, I don't think we're ready for that.
You're not ready. Obviously, get in touch with us if you have a question for the team. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter, or you can email your questions to podcast@ras.ac.uk and we'll try and cover them in a future episode. So all those burning questions about Saturn, get them sent in now. Also, for one last time, if you love the podcast and you enjoy it and you want to support us just that little bit more, our book, The Year in Space, is still available. It covers all the big news stories from last year. A lot of stuff on JWST, which I know you all love. So, you know, have a look at it. We'll put a link in the description if you'd like to get a copy. But until next time, everybody, happy stargazing.